identity being used to invoke war crimes and to justify or excuse apartheid policies. I took this case because it's important that people understand that a great number of Jews don't buy this and won't stand for it, especially, by the way, although I'm not younger, almost a majority of Jews under 40 recognize that Israel is an apartheid state and don't support any of these principles. And it's important that people understand that.
Mark, how can listeners follow both this case and your work?
Go to liberatedethnicstudies.org.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Law & Disorder, and even more so for everything you do every day in this cause. It's important to us, it's important to our listeners, and frankly, to the American people. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Steve and Heidi, and I am so grateful for your support and commitment to educating people about all of this. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law & Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss a lawsuit that has special meaning this week that we honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
We'll speak with civil rights attorney Flint Taylor about new evidence alleging FBI and NYPD involvement in the assassination of Malcolm X.
We speak with Professor Emeritus from Purdue University, Bill Mullen, on Black resistance to fascism. Bill's written two books, We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law, and The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition. What Bill has to say is profound. We can't rely on anything but ourselves in the streets, demonstrating from day one.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. A groundbreaking legal case seeks justice for the family of one of our country's most iconic civil rights leaders, Malcolm X. In an unprecedented lawsuit filed by his daughters, the Shabazz family is challenging the U.S. government, the city of New York, and several high-ranking law enforcement agencies. At the heart of the case is the claim that state actors, including the FBI and NYPD, played an active role in the assassination of Malcolm X on February 22, 1965, and that this involvement has been systematically covered up for decades. This suit, Malcolm X Shabazz et al. Versus USA, not only seeks justice for the wrongful death of Malcolm X, but also aims to hold the government accountable for its complicity in the assassination. The case draws on newly uncovered evidence linking federal agencies to the events surrounding Malcolm X's death, as well as for framing and wrongfully convicting two men who were only recently exonerated in 2021. The legal team behind this case includes civil rights attorneys Benjamin Crump and G. Flint Taylor. If successful, their argument could rewrite the historical narrative surrounding one of our country's tragic and significant moments. At the core of this case is the question, how deep was the state's involvement in silencing Malcolm X? How coordinated was the campaign to prevent the rise of Black leaders? And what has been the scope of the government's role in suppressing movements for racial justice and civil rights, both in the past and in the present day? We're joined by attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Flint represented the family of Fred Hampton and revealed that the FBI and Chicago Police Department murdered him in 1969. Flint is an editor of the Police Misconduct Law Reporter and is the author of Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Maria. It's really nice to be with you and Heidi again, and I'm looking forward to discussing this very important topic.
Well, why don't you start by telling us a little more about the lawsuit filed by the Shabazz family? What are its main objectives, and what are the key claims made against the government and law enforcement agencies?
Well, as you know, it's almost 60 years since the assassination of Malcolm X, and a tremendous amount of evidence, so to speak, has come out over the years, but particularly important evidence came out approximately 3 years ago in the case.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Mexico, we've had very good talks with them, and this is retaliatory. This is retaliatory to a certain extent. Millions of people flowed into our country through Mexico and Canada, and we're not going to allow that.
President Donald Trump imposes sweeping tariffs on the three largest trading partners of the United States, Mexico, Canada, and China. Global stocks are tumbling. Then the staff of USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, is told to stay home. This comes after tech billionaire Elon Musk says Trump has agreed to shut USAID down.
And USAID is a ball of worms. Mm-hmm. There is no apple. And when there is no apple, you've just got to basically get rid of the whole thing.
We'll look at the impact of Musk's move with former USAID staffer Jeremy Kanandike, president of Refugees International. And as Elon Musk and his so-called Department of Government Efficiency gets access to classified details by taking over the State Department, the Treasury Department, we'll speak with longtime Democratic strategist Waleed Shaheed, who says Elon Musk is staging a coup. And with Lindsay Owens of Groundwork Collaborative, who says there are several reasons Musk wants to control Treasury payments. None of them are good. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Global stocks are tumbling after President Donald Trump imposed 25% tariffs on most imports from Canada and Mexico and 10% on goods from China. The White House said the tariffs are needed to hold the three countries, quote, accountable to their promises of halting illegal immigration and stopping poisonous fentanyl and other drugs from flowing into our country, unquote. Trump's also threatening new tariffs on the European Union. Economists have widely criticized the tariffs, which are expected to raise consumer prices. The Wall Street Journal published an editorial headlined, "The Dumbest Trade War in History." Mexico and Canada responded by issuing retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. This is Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum.
Mexico no quiere confrontación.
Mexico does not want confrontation. We start from the collaboration between neighboring countries. Mexico not only does not want fentanyl to reach the United States, but we do not want it to reach anywhere. Therefore, if the United States wants to fight criminal groups and wants us to do it jointly, we must work in an integral way.
We'll speak with Lori Wallach after headlines. The future of USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, is in doubt after a dramatic weekend. The agency's website has been dark since Saturday. Workers have been told not to come to work today at the agency's headquarters. On Saturday, USAID's director of security and his deputy were placed on leave after they attempted to block Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency from accessing USAID's classified systems. New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wrote, quote, "This is a five-alarm fire. The people elected Donald Trump to be president, not Elon Musk. Having an unelected billionaire billionaire with his own foreign debts and motives raiding U.S. classified information is a grave threat to national security. This should not be a partisan issue, AOC said. On Sunday, Musk said, quote, USAID is a criminal organization. It's time for it to die. Musk also said Trump agrees that, quote, we should shut it down. Trump weighed in by claiming the aid agency is run by a bunch of radical lunatics, unquote. Doctors Without Borders warns the dismantling of the U.S. humanitarian aid system will cause a, quote, unmitigated humanitarian disaster affecting millions of the world's most vulnerable people, unquote. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. The top-ranking career U.S. Treasury Department official has been forced out of the agency after he resisted a demand by Elon Musk and his associates at Doge to gain access to the government's vast payment system, which disperses trillions of dollars in federal payments each year. Trump's new Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, ended up giving Musk access to the system, which includes sensitive information about taxpayers, Social Security recipients, and government contractors. Musk is also accused of waging a takeover at the Office of Personnel Management, where career civil servants have been locked out of computer systems. The Trump administration's continuing purges of federal workers across numerous other agencies. On Friday, the Justice Department fired at least 30 federal prosecutors who worked on January 6 criminal cases. Meanwhile, thousands of FBI agents have been asked to fill out a questionnaire by today detailing their role in probing the Capitol insurrection. The Trump administration's also fired Rohit Chopra, the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Meanwhile, the Education Department has placed on leave at least 55 workers who'd attended diversity trainings during the first Trump administration. President Trump has reiterated his threat to retake the Panama Canal hours after U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio visited Panama on his first foreign trip in his new post. According to the State Department, Rubio demanded, quote, immediate changes in Panama to reduce China's influence in the country, including at the canal. Panama's president, Jose Raul Molino, spoke on Sunday.
The sovereignty of Panama is not up for debate. That is very important. There is no doubt that the canal is operated by our country, and it will continue to be so.
President Trump threatened to cut off funding to South Africa, the home country of Elon Musk. In a post online, Trump wrote, quote, South Africa is confiscating land and treating certain classes of people very badly, in all caps, the very badly. Trump was referring to a land reform law in South Africa where the country's white minority still owns the vast majority of farmland 30 years after the end of apartheid rule. South Africa's Minister of Mineral and Petroleum Resources, Gwede Mantashe, responded to Trump's threat earlier today.
You passed an exploration act, therefore Trump would withhold funding to South Africa. And I said, let's not mobilize Africa. Let's withhold minerals to U.S. That is it. If they don't give us money, let's not give them minerals.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has landed in Washington, D.C. to meet with President Trump. It's Netanyahu's first trip to the United States since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for him in November for crimes against humanity and war crimes in Gaza. Netanyahu's trip comes just days after Hamas released three more hostages held in Gaza in exchange for 183 Palestinians jailed by Israel. The Palestinian Prisoners Society said many of the released Palestinians showed signs of torture and starvation. Meanwhile, Arab foreign ministers have formally rejected calls by Trump to transfer Palestinians in Gaza to Egypt and Jordan. In a joint statement, the foreign ministers wrote, quote, we affirm our rejection of any attempts to compromise Palestinians' inalienable rights, whether through settlement activities or evictions or annex of land or through vacating the land from its owners, unquote. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has called for an emergency UN Security Council meeting to discuss Israel's escalating attacks on Jenin in the occupied West Bank. On Saturday, Israeli forces blew up an entire residential block of 23 homes in the Jenin refugee camp. Israel's offensive has killed more than 50 Palestinians, displaced more than 15,000. On Thursday, Palestine's Prime Minister Mohammed Mustafa said Israel's attacks on the West Bank are a, quote, systematic effort to destroy the foundations of the Palestinian state, unquote. In Sudan, an attack Saturday by the Rapid Support Forces on an open market in the city of Omdurman killed at least 54 people and wounded more than 150 others. Sudan's doctors syndicate said most of the victims were women and children, and that one mortar shell landed just yards away from Al-Noor Hospital. The hospital is suffering a major staffing shortage as nearly 2 years of civil war in Sudan has nearly decimated the health system. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, at least 773 people were killed over the past week after rebels seized the eastern city of Goma. Another 3,000 people have been wounded in Goma, according to Congo's health ministry. Local health officials say morgues are filled beyond capacity and hospitals are overwhelmed. This is Abdou Ramen Sidibe, a surgeon with the Red Cross in Goma.
Habitué à avoir des blessures par balle, c'est des blessures entrées-sorties.
We are generally used to treating gunshot wounds. These are entry-exit wounds that reach an organ or a limb. But in recent days, we have received many injuries, not only from bullets, because these are civilians who do not wear bulletproof vests. As a result, we have seen many abdominal injuries. In addition to that, we have received injuries caused by explosive devices. The use of explosives in a populated area has resulted in many injuries. These are complex wounds. The medical care is very difficult and complicated.
Aid groups warn Goma's population of more than 2 million people is at risk of catastrophic humanitarian consequences. There have also been widespread reports of rape by armed groups and against women and girls. The DRC has called for an arms embargo against Rwanda over its backing of the M23 fighters and for Rwanda to withdraw its troops from the region. The DRC is home to vast reserves of metals and rare minerals, which Rwanda, the U.S., China, Europe, and Uganda have all exploited at the expense of the Congolese people. U.S. Navy and Air Force warplanes carried out airstrikes in northern Somalia Saturday, targeting the Islamic State. It was one of the first major U.S. military operations since Trump took office. The U.S. also bombed northwest Syria on Thursday. The Trump administration is preparing to end TPS, that's temporary protected status, for over 300,000 Venezuelans living in the United States as Trump escalates his crackdown on immigrants. The affected individuals were granted TPS status in 2023 and received an 18-month extension by the Biden administration. But the order seeks to end their protections just 60 days after the termination notice is published, a move lawyers say is plainly illegal. Meanwhile, Venezuela's reportedly agreed to accept deportation flights from the U.S. after talks with Trump envoy Richard Grenell, who met with the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro in Caracas on Friday. Grenell returned to the U.S. from Caracas with six Americans who'd been jailed in Venezuela. In more immigration news, the Trump administration seeking to access a database maintained by the Office of Refugee Resettlement with information on hundreds of thousands of unaccompanied immigrant children. Rights advocates warn Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, could use the data to further its crackdown, separating more families and causing more harm to the children. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is visiting troops on the militarized southern border today. He posted ahead of his trip, quote, POTUS wants 100% operational control of the border and we will deliver border security as national security, unquote. Major demonstrations have taken place across the United States and cities in recent days to protest the assault on immigrant communities. In Los Angeles, thousands of protesters rallied into the night Sunday, defying a heavy police presence. A group of demonstrators shut down the 101 freeway in downtown L.A. In Atlanta, thousands marched along Buford Highway on Saturday after ICE announced targeted operations in the city. Here in New York, the NYU Langone Health Hospital System has canceled appointments for some of its young transgender patients following Trump's executive order that aims to cut off federal support for hospitals that provide gender-affirming care. Hospitals in Colorado, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. have also started canceling gender-affirming care for youth, including prescriptions and refills. But some doctors are standing up for their young patients. Dr. Jeffrey Birnbaum, a pediatrician at University Hospital of Brooklyn, has told his patients, quote, "I'm willing to go to jail to continue to provide your care," unquote. In Washington, D.C., hundreds marched to Children's National Hospital in solidarity with trans patients who lost their care. The New York Times is reporting more than 8,000 government web pages across more than a dozen agencies have been taken down since Friday. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has scrubbed pages containing health information related to the LGBTQ care and to HIV. The State Department has deleted references to transgender travelers on its advisory page. The department has also stopped using the LGBTQI plus acronym. Pages now just say LGB to remove references to trans and intersex people. Louisiana has indicted a New York doctor for prescribing abortion pills to a Louisiana patient online. An arrest warrant has been issued for Dr. Margaret Carpenter, as well as the mother of the patient, who was a minor, on a felony charge of criminal abortion by means of abortion-inducing drugs. Under Louisiana's abortion ban, Dr. Carpenter could face a 15-year prison sentence, $200,000 in fines, and loss of her medical license. New York Governor Kathy Hochul vowed to uphold New York's shield laws as she issued this video response.
I will never, under any circumstances, turn this doctor over to the state of Louisiana under any extradition request.
And the Democratic National Committee on Saturday elected moderate political insider Ken Martin as its chair, despite calls from voters for Democrats to urgently switch gears and respond to working people's needs following the party's crushing defeat in November. 24-year-old gun control activist and survivor of the Parkland massacre, David Hogg, was elected to serve as one of the DNC's vice chairs, become the first Gen Z DNC member to hold the position. Activists with the group Climate Defiance disrupted events at the Democratic Convention to demand a clean break between Democrats and the fossil fuel industry. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with President Donald Trump's move to impose sweeping tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China, the three largest trading partners of the United States. Global stocks are tumbling after Trump imposed 25% tariffs on most imports from the U.S.'s allies, Canada and Mexico, and 10% on goods from China. Energy resources from Canada will have a lower 10% tariff. In a statement, the White House claimed that tariffs are needed to hold the three countries accountable to their promises of halting illegal immigration and stopping poisonous fentanyl and other drugs from flowing into our country, unquote. Trump is also threatening new tariffs on the European Union. On Sunday, Trump addressed reporters outside Joint Base Andrews.
Mexico, we've had very good talks with them, and this is retaliatory. This is retaliatory to a certain extent. Millions of people flowed into our country through Mexico and Canada, and we're not going to allow that.
Economists on the left and right have widely criticized Trump's move, which is expected to raise consumer prices. The extremely conservative editorial page of the Wall Street Journal's headline, "The Dumbest Trade War in History." The National Association of Manufacturers said they'll ultimately, quote, bear the brunt of these tariffs, undermining our ability to sell our products at a competitive price and putting American jobs at risk, unquote. But Trump defends the tariffs, saying he's fulfilling his campaign promise. He was questioned by reporters last week.
You promised Americans to try to reduce costs, and so many of the products that would be tariffed when they come into the country, the outgoing country is not paying the tariff, the buyers in the United States pay that, and then that's passed on to consumers in most instances.
Sometimes.
How would you expect to have prices come down if you have such a broad plan for tariffs? And what do you say to the voters who want to see you reduce everyday costs?
Well, let me just tell you that I got elected for a lot of reasons. Number one was the border. Number two was inflation, because I had almost no inflation. And yet I charged hundreds of billions of dollars of tariffs to countries. And think of it, I had almost no inflation and I took in $600 billion of money from other countries. And tariffs don't cause inflation, they cause success. It caused big success, so we're going to have great success. There could be some temporary short-term disruption, and people will understand that.
Meanwhile, Mexico and Canada responded to Trump's tariffs by issuing retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. This is Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum.
Mexico no quiere confrontación.
Mexico does not want confrontation. We start from the collaboration between neighboring countries. Mexico not only does not want fentanyl to reach the United States, but we do not want it to reach anywhere. Therefore, if the United States wants to fight criminal groups and wants us to do it jointly, we must work in an integral way.
And this was the response Saturday from Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to Trump's new tariffs.
I want to speak directly to Americans, our closest friends and neighbors. This is a choice that, yes, will harm Canadians, but beyond that, it will have real consequences for you, the American people. As I have consistently said, tariffs against Canada will put your jobs at risk, potentially shutting down American auto assembly plants and other manufacturing facilities. They will raise costs for you, including food at the grocery store, gas at the pump. They will impede your access to an affordable supply of vital goods crucial for U.S. security, such as nickel, potash, uranium, steel, and aluminum. They will violate the free trade agreement that the President and I, along with our Mexican partner, negotiated and signed a few years ago.
For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Lori Wallach, director of the Rethink Trade Program at American Economic Liberties Project, board member of Citizens Trade Campaign, the U.S. National Trade Justice Coalition of unions and environmental, consumer, faith, family, farm, and other groups. Lori, welcome back to Democracy Now! Respond to what's supposedly going to be enacted tomorrow. Now, let's be clear. That's Tuesday. Trudeau said he's tried to reach out to the president. He won't return his calls. The president says he's going to speak to both presidents, Mexico and Canadian prime minister and presidents today. What's going on here?
So tariffs can be a very effective tool to achieve lots of goals. If you're for enforceable labor standards and trade agreements to raise wages, you're for tariffs. If you are for border carbon adjustment to promote low carbon production, you're for tariffs. Tariffs are part of the formula of the tools you use to try and reestablish our ability to make things here that we need and create good jobs for the two-thirds of Americans who don't have a college degree, so making solar panels, medicine, EVs. But slapping on tariffs on Mexico and Canada, ostensibly about migration and drug trafficking, is not just ineffective. I mean, it's like trying to do surgery with a saxophone instead of a scalpel, but also is going to be damaging. It's going to cause enormous disruption, but without any of the outcomes and goals that one might actually want to use a tariff to achieve, to help working people or build our resilience.
What is Trump trying to accomplish here? Some have said, I mean, on one hand, he's been threatening China with tariffs, but he's doing, he said, 10% on China. And with his allies, Mexico and Canada, 25%. Some suggest that maybe the fact that Elon Musk has a factory in Shanghai brought down the tariffs on China. Your thoughts?
The reason probably for the 10% is that there are already around 20% tariffs on two-thirds of all of our trade with China, still in place from 2018 during the first Trump term. And then President Biden raised tariffs on EVs, on solar, and other things to 100% with respect to China. So this is 10% on top of the existing 20%. So actually now everything will have at least 10%, but a lot of stuff will have 30% or 100%. Coming from China. But, you know, here is the question. Again, tariffs, legitimate tool, but what is the purpose here? If you're trying to fix the redone NAFTA, the so-called U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which was Trump's redo of NAFTA, then there's a built-in six-year renegotiation that basically starts now. If you can't fix it, you get rid of the whole thing. But there's a process to do that. You know, USMCA was supposed to bring down the NAFTA trade deficit and end job offshoring. Instead, since 2020, the trade deficit's doubled and offshoring's continued. So that Trump trade negotiation clearly needs some fixing. But there's a way to do that. It's not the tariffs. Or if you're trying to generally use tariffs to try and rebalance our chronic trade imbalance, which is promoted in deindustrialization and income inequality, well, then you use a variety of tools together, including to make sure that the companies that have had record profits from this old system pay for the transition by making it easier to organize unions and doing anti-price gouging policies so companies don't use their monopoly power to raise prices. Even if you're trying to stop the flow of fentanyl, bizarrely, if you actually read the executive order, there's a loophole. The president has authority called the de minimis loophole we've talked about before. The president has existing authority to close, and they still allow informal entries of these 4 million packages a day in which the fentanyl is buried, which he could have fixed if he really was focusing on drugs. So it is a very mysterious and potentially damaging state of affairs.
And in the case of fentanyl, I think in 2024, there were like 43 pounds of fentanyl that was seized at the American-Canadian border. I think more went the other way. I also want to turn to the UAW president, Sean Fain, on tariffs. He wrote on social media, the UAW supports aggressive tariff action to protect American manufacturing jobs as a good first step to undoing decades of anti-worker trade policy. We do not support using factory workers as pawns in a fight over immigration or drug policy, he said. Lori Wallach, your response.
So I think UAW President Sean Fain had it exactly right. And actually, in my long tweet thread about these tariffs, I cited him because, again, as I started out, tariffs are a really powerful tool. And when used particularly in combination with things like investment policies to try and actually spur domestic production capacity, new factories, creating demand for American-made, high-wage, high-environmental standard goods, by putting together a package of policies and keeping them in place, not just random tariff here, could go away tomorrow, you actually incentivize the kind of investment you could rebalance. We certainly don't want to hold on to the old devastating neoliberal trade agenda. But the random tariffs on Mexico and Canada compared to a strategic use of tariffs with a mix of other tools are the random tariffs aren't going to get you the outcome you want, even on the fentanyl, again, closing the de minimis loophole, a thing a president has authority to do, stopping the ability of 4 million packages, mainly e-commerce packages, mainly from China, to come in uninspected without the normal customs information. So they closed half of this in this executive order. They said that stuff can't slip in without paying tariffs anymore. Okay. But then they allow the stuff to come in uninspected. And so ostensibly, if you're trying to stop fentanyl, probably more important than the pay the tariff is the don't sneak in the stuff uninspected. But they didn't do that. This is something they could actually fix tomorrow if they wanted to. The bigger use of trade policies to try and fix our mess, what they did or may or may not impose tonight at midnight, doesn't fit into an agenda of making things better for working people or the planet. Not here, not anywhere.
And let's talk about immigrants. AP cites a new study by Warwick McKibben and Marcus Noland of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. The study found, quote, for Mexico, a 25% tariff would be catastrophic. Moreover, the economic decline caused by the tariff could increase the incentive for Mexican immigrants to cross the border into the U.S., directly contradicting another Trump administration priority. Lori Wallach.
Well, I mean, this is, again, the perverse irony. There was a Trump trade plan issued on January 20th that laid out in an orderly fashion a rational sense of how to do a new trade agenda. This is unrelated to that because, for instance, one of the things that spurred the original wave of migration from Mexico to the United States was NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which displaced millions of campesino peasant families off of their rural livelihoods by dumping subsidized U.S. corn into Mexico and suddenly destroying the livelihoods of millions of people who first went to the border, to the low-wage maquiladora plants, couldn't make a living there, couldn't feed your family on $5 a day, and then used migration to try and come to make a living for themselves and their families, in a way forced by this economic displacement of the neoliberal trade agreements. And we saw that repeated with Central America Free Trade Agreement and increased migration from Central America. So if we want to get to the root causes of the neoliberal economic policies imposed through these so-called trade agreements and junk them, yes, that has to happen. Is what 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada, unrelated to any of those economic goals, going to help the situation versus make it worse? No. Are tariffs part of the solution? Yes. Is this use of tariffs going to help? No, it could make things much worse.
Lori Wallach, thank you for being with us, director of the Rethink Trade Program at the American Economic Liberties Project and a board member of the Citizens Trade Campaign. Next up, the staff of USAID, that's the U.S. Agency for International Development, got an early morning email today to stay home. We'll look at Elon Musk's move to shut down the agency with a former USAID staffer, now president of Refugees International. Stay with us. Soul by Monk Higgins. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The future of USAID, that's the U.S. Agency for International Development, is uncertain. After Elon Musk said President Trump has agreed to shut it down. After a dramatic spat with the USAID senior officials and workers played out over the weekend, early this morning, Musk went on X, the social media platform he owns, and claimed the agency is, quote, beyond repair.
And USAID is a ball of worms. Mm-hmm. There is no apple. Mm-hmm. And when there is no apple, you've just got to basically get rid of the whole thing.
USAID's website has been down since Saturday. Workers have been instructed not to come to work at the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C. That's closed today. Hundreds of workers have been reportedly locked out of USAID's computer systems overnight, with dozens more put on leave. This includes the two top USAID security officials who were placed on administrative leave on Saturday night after they blocked members of Musk risks so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, from accessing USAID's classified systems, including personnel files and information about contracts, for example, with Musk's rivals. Since then, four members of DOGE have reportedly been granted access to the agency's systems now that the security officials are out of the way. Meanwhile, last week, Reuters reported hundreds of USAID contractors were put on unpaid leave. Some were being terminated after Trump imposed a sweeping freeze on U.S. foreign aid. On Sunday, Elon Musk posted a series of comments on X attacking USAID. He wrote, quote, USAID was a viper's nest of radical left Marxists who hate America. He also said, quote, USAID is a criminal organization. Time for it to die. And, quote, did you know that USAID, using your tax dollars, funded bioweapon research, including COVID-19, that killed millions of people? Unquote. President Trump weighed in Sunday night.
It's been run by a bunch of radical lunatics, and we're getting them out. USAID, run by radical lunatics, and we're getting them out, and then we'll make a decision.
Doctors Without Borders has warned the dismantling of USAID, the U.S. humanitarian aid system, quote, will cause an unmitigated humanitarian disaster affecting millions of the world's most vulnerable people, unquote. Congressional Democrats also raised alarm over Musk's move to access classified material at USAID. New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wrote on social media, quote, this is a five-alarm fire. The people elected Donald Trump to be president, not Elon Musk. Having an unelected billionaire with his own foreign debts and motives raiding U.S. classified information is a grave threat to national security. This should not be a partisan issue, AOC wrote. USAID was established by President John F. Kennedy in 1961. For more, we go to Jeremy Kanondike, president of Refugees International. He previously worked in several senior positions at USAID. He was most recently USAID's lead official for COVID-19 in the Biden administration. Thanks so much for being with us, Jeremy. Respond to what has taken place as late as just in the last few hours when the workers at the headquarters of USAID were told to stay home, the office closed.
So over the weekend, we have seen a concerted campaign of disinformation about what USAID is, about what USAID does. A total mischaracterization really doesn't cover it. It is outright disinformation. You heard it from Elon Musk in the clips that you played earlier. You know, it bears no relation whatsoever to the reality of what USAID's work has been for 60 plus years. USAID does development and relief programs around the world. It has helped to save 25 million lives from HIV. It has responded to famines and earthquakes. That was the work that I did in part while I was there during the Obama years. It has promoted democracy. You know, what we are seeing instead are, you know, these attacks against it as a sort of corrupt and illegal organization by people who know nothing about it. They are manufacturing these things out of whole cloth. And you know, you have to ask, well, why are they doing this and why are they targeting USAID? Because the stakes here are not just that we lose what USAID has done for American values and interests and has done for the world. What we are losing here is the integrity, really, of the federal government. If they can do this to an independent federal agency that is mandated by Congress, they can really do it anywhere.
So explain the battle that took place this weekend that led the two top security folks at USAID to be put on leave on Saturday night, and also the kind of information that now that they're removed, Elon Musk, what kind of security clearance does he have? What kind of conflict of interest investigation has been done of him? Background checks to get classified access? And is it true that he's getting information about contracts of his rivals?
So I have not seen any reporting that suggests that Elon Musk has a valid security clearance. particularly to access the systems that it seems like they were trying to access, which were tapped into, you know, the highest level national security networks that the U.S. government has. USAID is a national security agency. It's, you know, it conducts foreign policy work. And as such, in its what are called SCIFs, those are the rooms where special compartmentalized information can be stored. It has a couple of SCIFs, as all the national security organizations do. And you know, most staff at USAID rarely go in there and never need to consume that information. When I was working on COVID, I, you know, barely went in that room. But it exists. It's there for some of the programs that need it. And Elon, through that, if he has access to that, if his minions on this, you know, Doge group of 20-somethings have access to that, that is some of the most sensitive national security information that the U.S. government possesses. None of them, as far as I have heard, have a valid clearance for that. And I think what you saw or what reported of the two security staff is that they tried, as they are legally required to do, they tried to block people without a valid clearance from breaching classified information. And for that, they were pushed out of the agency. And reportedly, the Trump-appointed chief of staff who had just arrived also resigned over this. So, I mean, that should be a huge, huge, huge alarm bell. In terms of specific contract information, I'm not sure what rivals he might be looking for. I don't get the sense he's looking for a competitive edge here or something. I think he is just looking to destroy this agency, because if they can destroy this agency without any consultation with Congress, without any public disclosure of what they're doing, without even an executive order giving them fig leaf from the president to do this, if a private citizen can just go in and destroy a federal agency, then we are in a dire, dire place as a government and as a country.
Africa CDC Director General Dr. Jean Kasaya explained the scale of the aid Africa receives from the U.S. and the possible effects of the pause. He was speaking on CNN last week.
In 2024, we got $8 billion of support from the U.S. to African continent, and 73% went to the health sector. It means today the U.S. is the main partner that we have bilaterally and also multilaterally through a number of organs and organizations. What we see as a trend today in Africa, it's not just the pause from the U.S. government, but it's also the reduction from assistance from other Western countries. And that one is a major threat to not only Africa, but to the world. And as Africa CDC is projecting with this trend to have around 2 to 4 million additional deaths annually. And that one will also increase the likelihood occurrence of pandemics.
The former head of global health at USAID, Dr. Atul Gawande, also posted on social media Saturday, quote, "I oversaw global health programs at USAID. They reached hundreds of millions of people, added 6 extra years to the lifespan of children of partner countries, and were eradicating health threats worldwide. What insanity and cruelty to break that," he said. And then you have one of the last hospitals in central Gaza being closed down this weekend because they lost their USAID funding. This at a time when the U.S. government, Trump, has approved 2,000-pound bombs being sent to Israel when it comes to helping the folks of Palestine, of the Palestinians in Gaza. Their aid is being cut even further, Jeremy Kanundike.
Yes, and I think it's really important to understand that a lot of what USAID does saves lives every single day. I ran the humanitarian team there for several years. We would respond to famines. We would respond to earthquakes, tsunamis. We led the response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014. You know, these are life-saving activities. 20 million people are on AIDS drugs in Africa right now and around the world through USAID and U.S. government support. All of that is at risk. So the stakes here really are that global health threats that could threaten the United States go unchecked. We pull back the tools that we have. The stakes are that hundreds of thousands of people could die of starvation in Sudan as we pull back the humanitarian assistance amidst the famine there. The ceasefire in Gaza, which is premised in part on greater access to humanitarian aid, could be put at risk by pulling back humanitarian assistance there. The ability of the U.S. to support human rights and support democracy around the world, which is a really core part as well of what USAID does, and it's why it's targeted by countries like Russia, who are frankly celebrating this openly this weekend. That is really important, and that will be lost as well.
Jeremy Canundike, I want to thank you so much for being with us. President of Refugees International, formerly held several senior positions at USAID. Most recently, USAID's lead official for COVID-19 in the Biden administration. Next up, Elon Musk is staging a coup at the State Department as he and his so-called Department of Government Efficiency get access to classified details by taking over the Treasury Department. We'll talk with the Democratic strategist who wrote a piece with Elon Musk is staging a coup as its headline. Stay with us. Club by Chapel Roan. In accepting the 2025 Grammy for Best New Artist, this is what Roan said.
I told myself if I ever won a Grammy and I got to stand up here in front of the most powerful people in music, I would demand that labels and the industry profiting millions of dollars off of artists would offer a livable wage and health care, especially to developing artists. Labels, we got you, but do you got us?
That was Chapel Roan accepting the 2025 Grammy for Best New Artist Sunday night. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The top-ranking career U.S. Treasury Department official, David LeBrick, has been forced out of the agency after he resisted a demand by Elon Musk and his associates at Doge to gain access to the government's vast payment system, which disperses trillions of dollars in federal payments each year. Trump's new Treasury Secretary, the billionaire Scott Bessent, ended up giving Musk access to the system, which includes sensitive information about taxpayers, Social Security recipients, government contractors, including Musk's rivals. Musk is also accused of waging a takeover at the Office of Personnel Management, where career civil servants have been locked out of computer systems. For more, we're joined by two guests. Waleed Shaheed is Democratic strategist. His new piece on Substack is headlined, Elon Musk is staging a coup. Waleed was previously the spokesperson for Justice Democrats and former senior advisor for the campaigns of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jamal Bowman. We're also joined in Washington, D.C. by Lindsay Owens, executive director of the Groundwork Collaborative, who says there are several reasons Musk wants to control Treasury payments. None of them are good. Okay, Waleed Shaheed, let's begin with you. What do you mean that Elon Musk is staging a coup?
So if this story was taking place somewhere in Central Asia or in Africa, the United States media, the United States State Department, international institutions would likely refer to this as a coup. A billionaire industrialist who donated $300 million to a campaign is installing his personal loyalists in key parts of the federal bureaucracy. This is essentially Viktor Orban's playbook. And we need to know, why does a billionaire industrialist with millions in government contracts, military contracts for his private companies need the social security numbers of every American, needs to know what every single check that the U.S. government gives out to businesses, to charities, why does this billionaire need to know this information? He was not vetted or approved by the U.S. Senate. He has a history of corruption for using public resources for private gain. He's one of the wealthiest men in the world. And in any other situation, this would be called state capture, and people around the world would be condemning it. But in the United States, we are not used to this kind of level of creeping authoritarianism, of plutocracy, of oligarchy so explicit. And we need to, this is a, as Representative Ocasio-Cortez said last night, this is a five-alarm fire. Senate Democrats need to be communicating to the American people. And last night there was a call by Indivisible Action for people to visit their senators and call for them to grind the Senate to a halt, to call for investigations, and to know, why does Elon Musk need to know this information? Why is he showing up on Saturday to the offices of the federal government demanding the private information of citizens all around the country?
Well, Lindsay Owens, you say none of the reasons are good. Lay those out.
Yeah, absolutely. So for most Americans, this is the first time that they've ever heard of the Treasury payment system. So what is the Treasury payment system? This is effectively the piece of the federal government that cuts the checks, and they cut a lot of checks. This is $6 trillion a year, money that goes to individuals as Social Security payments for seniors, money that goes for organizations like Meals on Wheels to deliver lunches, foreign aid, as well as the funding that the government sets aside for key programs, paying its debts, making sure that we don't breach the debt ceiling and default on our obligations. So this is really unprecedented that Elon Musk has grabbed control of the keys of $6 trillion in payments infrastructure. There are a few reasons this could be happening. The first is, as your viewers know, last week, President Trump tried to end federal spending, just stop federal payments altogether. This was so outrageous and in violation of the Constitution that the courts intervened and said that he couldn't do that. What may be happening here is that Musk may be doing an end run around the courts, going straight to the source so that he can continue to stop those payments that the courts said needed to keep staying online. The second thing that may be happening here is this could just be a good old-fashioned cyber attack. Elon Musk could be interested in the Social Security numbers, the tax ID numbers of tens of millions of Americans. We know that he has partnered with Visa and is considering spinning out a payment system of his own. What we may have here is Elon Musk's attempt to get the private information for his own financial gain. The other thing that is incredibly worrying here is $6 trillion in spending is not just a lot of money. It's a macroeconomically significant amount of money. If Elon Musk starts tinkering with the code, the underlying technology that makes sure these payments go out seamlessly and effectively, he could inadvertently or on purpose bring the macroeconomy to a halt. I mean, this is an incredibly concerning seizure of government infrastructure, but it is also an economically significant moment in the country. So I couldn't agree with Waleed more. I mean, the word coup is the right word to be thinking about here, and Congress must intervene. I mean, if I was a senator, I think the most important thing to do is bring the Secretary of the Treasury to the Senate today to answer questions about what Musk has access to.
So the Treasury Department's Inspector General, who could monitor DOGE's activities, was among the 15 watchdogs who were purged by President Trump. Who's now in charge of or overseeing Musk's team?
Yeah, Musk is in charge. So that's exactly right. Some of the key chokeholds here to make sure that something like this doesn't happen have been moved out of the way, studiously, exactingly moved out of the way. So President Trump fired the Inspector General of the Treasury and the top civil servant of the Treasury Department, the man who was the acting Treasury Secretary between the time that Janet Yellen stepped down and Scott Bessent was confirmed by the Senate, has also been been pushed aside, resigned over the fact that he didn't want to give Musk, a private citizen, a billionaire, the keys to the Treasury payment system. So there is very little stopping Musk from taking this over. You know, Trump and Bessent have really, given him a glide path.
So, Waleed Shaheed, where is the Democratic Party on this? Where are the Democratic senators and Congress members on this? I mean, you have Hakeem Jeffries, who holds an emergency meeting of the Democrats after a judge stops the federal payments from going out to, stops the ban on federal funding.
So the Democratic Party in Washington is largely asleep at the wheel. They are acting as if they're kind of a librarian shushing noise in a crowded room. They're still believing in the normal procedures, normal decorum, that everything here is the normal transition of power. And they still believe that what Elon Musk and Donald Trump are doing is just a libertarian reform of the government, not an oligarchic, plutocratic takeover of a private billionaire who is seeking to know, potentially seeking to know what his competitors might be doing with government contracts. He has private information that Elon Musk has contracts with international governments all across the world. But the Democratic Party is not able to put forward an opposition message right now because they feel like this is normal. And that's why it's so important for concerned citizens all across the country to twist the arm of your Senate Democrat. Go to their office. If you go to indivisible.org today, you can find a way to join your local chapter. And all around the country, whether your senator is a Republican or a Democrat or independent, they need to hear from concerned citizens because the Democratic Party doesn't move on issues of oligarchy, of plutocracy, of taking action, unless their constituents show up in person and demand that they hold hearings, take the bully pulpit in the media, and also grind the Senate to a halt until we know why does Elon Musk have this information, someone who is not elected.
So the Democrat National Committee on Saturday elected the moderate political insider Ken Martin as chair, despite calls from voters to urgently switch gears and respond to working people's needs following the party's crushing defeat, though it wasn't a major numbers defeat, but it was a defeat in November. What do you think of Ken Martin? Where do you think it's going?
So the DNC is largely at this point a fundraising vehicle for the presidential campaign. I hope that Ken Martin reforms the party to do things like what I'm describing. The Democratic Party should be holding daily press conferences every morning to explain to working class and middle class Americans why it might hurt their pocketbooks for Elon Musk to have this information from the Treasury Department and from the OPM, that Elon Musk has a history of wanting to use public resources for private gain, that Elon Musk is someone who is live tweeting that he wants to cut the federal government's debt every day by billions of dollars. And one of the only ways to do that would be to begin to privatize Social Security. This is what the DNC should be doing. Now, Ken Martin, we had lots of members of the uncommitted movement at the DNC who were being personally bullied by their DNC state parties. And Ken Martin, thankfully, did intervene to make sure that that didn't happen. And so that was my only personal interaction with him. And he went out of his way to make sure that our uncommitted delegation was treated with respect. Other than that, I don't know that much about him. But I'm looking forward to, hopefully, he can put together a working class populist agenda for the party that isn't just a fundraising handoff.
So, Lindsay Owens, DOGE is not a formal government agency, right? Which means that it doesn't fall into any category.
Yeah, look, I think when President Trump announced that Elon Musk was going to be running the Department of Government Efficiency, there was a sort of tempting fantasy that maybe Musk, a tech successful businessman, could come in and restore some efficiency in government, maybe modernize some aspects of government that could use some updating. I mean, I think with this weekend's seizure of the Treasury payment system, we can be crystal clear in putting that fantasy to bed. This is Musk determining who is going to get funding in this country, what programs are going to be funded in this country. And remember, Musk isn't a disinterested party here. As we've talked about, he has many federal contracts himself, billions of dollars this year alone to his companies, SpaceX, Tesla, and X, formerly known as Twitter. But he also is interested in cutting this funding for a very personal reason, which is he is interested in paying for the tax cuts that Congress is teeing up this year. They are estimating $5 trillion in tax cuts, mostly going to the wealthy and corporations. And Doge is the entity that is supposedly going to find the money, find the savings to pay for those tax cuts. So I think we can sum it up this way. Elon Musk is going to pay for his tax cut with your Social Security. That's really what we're looking at here. That's what Doge is up to.
And Lindsay Owens, we're going to have to leave it there. And I just want to give Waleed the last word. 10 seconds. What should people do right now?
People should go to indivisible.org and visit their Senate office and demand an investigation of Elon Musk, and that Senate business should come to a halt.
We want to thank Waleed Shaheed, Democratic strategist. We'll link to his piece, Elon Musk is staging a coup. And Lindsay Owens, thanks for joining us from Groundwork Collaborative. In your piece, there are several reasons Musk wants to control Treasury payments. None of them are good, she writes. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to Ebony Spectrum. Here are some of the things that you missed last week from some of our media partners.
Mr. Kennedy, I was struck by your comments during our meeting last week.
What?
I was struck by your comments in our meeting last week, where you made it abundantly clear to me that you intended to clean house of the professional scientist at the National Institutes of Health, which you know is headquartered in the state of Maryland and employs thousands of hardworking Marylanders. I, for the record, believe in scientists and I believe in doctors and I trust them over politicians without medical degrees. You talked about bad science and bad scientists. And in fact, you specifically said to me in response to my question that you intend to replace the bad scientist with the good scientist. And so I want to ask you, in your opinion, what makes a scientist or a doctor qualified to serve at the National Institutes of Health?
A scientist who's devoted to empirical methodology, to evidence-based science, a scientist who understand the importance of replication, the importance of publishing raw data and being open and transparent about it, the importance of publishing peer review. We have, NIH has overseen over the past several years the decline, the precipitous decline in American health. There's 91,000 people at HHS, and are you suggesting that some of them should not be held responsible for that decline? They were in charge of protecting our health.
Let me just say this, because I only have 3 minutes left. I don't set the rules here, but I ask the questions. And the question is really whether you intend, as you said, to substitute essentially your judgment for the judgment of these professional scientists.
I'm not going to substitute my judgment for science. Of course, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do, listen, the New York Times just did an article last week talking about the fraud, the 20-year fraud, 800 fraudulent studies produced by NIH on amyloid plaques and not allowing any other hypothesis about the cause of Alzheimer's.
Well, how will you decide, Mr. Kennedy, which scientist Are they the ones who disagree with you?
The ones who are corrupt. The ones who have been doing science like the amyloid plaque studies that were fraudulent.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have a medical degree?
Do I know?
Okay, let me go to the next question. The Heritage Fund has compiled a watch list of federal employees to go after federal staff. Is there a watch list for federal staff at HHS?
Not that I know of.
Have you or has anyone in the administration developed a list of career scientists or federal staff that you would target for termination?
Not that I know of.
And let me just ask you another question. Now, your failed presidential campaign has been raising money to try and cover your debts. And you were questioned about this yesterday and failed to answer a question that Senator Warren asked you. And so I want to ask you again regarding these emails that you have sent to raise money. How much has your presidential campaign made fundraising off of this administration's complete disregard for the workforce at HHS?
Excuse me? I didn't hear the question. The last part.
How much money has your presidential campaign made off of fundraising off of this administration's complete disregard for the workforce at HHS?
Zero.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask unanimous consent to enter into the record two emails from this week and the week before regarding fundraising that you are currently doing through your presidential campaign.
Without objection.
And finally, I want to ask you, I have a, you said to, you were on a show